Welcome. This is Jean Maroney of Thinking Directions, and today I am hosting the HBL Meeting of the Minds on behalf of my husband. He is on a plane to California, and so he asked me to cover it, and I asked him if I could just interview Christopher Blakeslee, and he said sure, so he'll have to make this up later. So for those of you who don't know Christopher, he has been on HBL for over 10 years, and I first got to know him from a lot of very interesting HBL posts that he was writing on all different subjects, politics, epistemology, as I recall, pretty much covering the gamut. And then he reached out to me to do a thinking tactics workshop in Kansas City, and he orchestrated that. You know, I haven't done too many recently, but basically, if you could get 10 people together in any city, I would show up and do a thinking tactics workshop, and Christopher got 10 people together. So I went out to Kansas City. I got to meet him. And I've always been very impressed with the intellectual level of Christopher's thinking. And that was, and I had a great time meeting him in Kansas City. And I found out later he was dealing with some really difficult chronic health issues. And we wound up, he joined the Thinking Lab, and we wound up basically emailing once a year for years, where I would get an update on his health situation, and it was really difficult. I mean, it was really, he had ambitious goals, and he was being shut down by chronic health issues, both internal and muscular and everything. And it was a really bleak period, and I did what I could to give him encouragement. But the big thing at a certain point, and I take credit for my visionary thing here, at a certain point in our back and forth, I said, you know what, Christopher? You are the person who is going to figure out how to solve these health problems. There was no doctor who could do it. There was no one person who could do it. And I said, you're the one with the brain and the knowledge, which was becoming encyclopedic on the various medical issues, and you are going to figure out the solution to this. And he has. And you look at him, if those of you who can see video, you see a very healthy looking young man. And I'll tell you, I saw him, he looks great. When I saw him at Austin, I almost didn't recognize him because he looks so much healthier than he did when I first met him. The face is the same, the voice is the same, but he's really transformed his body and his life. And he is vibrantly alive now. And objectivism had a huge part in that. So I'm a Christopher advocate, and I thought I've been looking for an opportunity to share his story with objectivists. And so we thought we would take this opportunity to talk about the top five ways that objectivism helped him survive and solve his health problems. And this is now his profession, is helping other people do this. So Christopher, welcome to the call.
Thanks, Jean. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you. And this is extra special for me. It's ever since what I've gone through, I make sure that I cherish everything. And 5 years ago, there is no way that I thought we'd be having this conversation. And even whenever you told me that I would solve all this, my initial reaction was, I don't even know how to do the first thing to function. So how in the world am I going to figure this out? So it's really cool to be on here. And thanks for having me on.
Yes, thank you for coming. So you suggested maybe start by giving the thumbnail sketch. I mean, it's a long story, but Christopher is going to try to give you the thumbnail sketch on his really dramatic health issues that go back to what, age 7 or something like that? Or?
It's even earlier than that, actually. Yeah. So I'm 41 years old now. As of October 17th, I've been an objectivist for 15 years. But my chronic health stuff started whenever I was 5 years old, like just the interspersal of some symptoms, some bladder stuff, some headaches and whatnot. And it went from there. It kept escalating to the point where it became chronic whenever I was 16 years old, and I developed things. Interstitial cystitis is the primary diagnosis that I was given eventually.
And what exactly is the major symptom of that?
It just means bladder inflammation. It doesn't say what the cause of it is or anything. It just means your bladder is doing stuff that it shouldn't. And then later I got diagnosed with fibromyalgia, burning mouth syndrome, trigeminal and occipital nerve irritation, along with peripheral neuropathy. And that is the nerves that go through and branch through your face and make smiling very, very painful. And that's why I stopped shaving and stopped cutting my hair for such a long period of time.
So and, hold on 1 second, just so people know, fibromyalgia, if you haven't heard of it, this is pain all over your body, excruciating pain, actually, triggered by all different things. So this is, you were basically living in pain.
Right.
At all times.
Nonstop pain ever since I was 16 years old. Mm-hmm. And I've been interviewed about it. This is the fifth time now, but I describe myself as basically legendarily ill. So let's get into the concretes of what that is, because I now work with someone who works with the Dr. Terry Walls, who, if people don't know about her, she had progressive MS to the point where she was in a wheelchair and she managed to reverse her health problems. And that person told me that they've never heard of someone healing to the degree that I did. So I really was taken aback by that. And the things that were so extreme were that I was essentially bedbound with agonizing pain for 15 years. I went through so many things with it just kept creeping on me where I wouldn't really move and such. And my nervous system got so hypersensitive that things like watching TV and listening to music felt like all these needles stabbing me in my abdomen and such. And now that I understand the nervous system and neuroscience, I understand why that was the case. The sensitization was so high and it kept creeping through my body. I would trade basically one position that was comfortable, that wasn't ergonomically correct, that would then cause a new problem. I would develop shoulder pain from leaning on my side all day. And it got to the point where some of the more extreme things are that talking and reading became very painful to me. And I'm still really thankful my mom read all of Atlas Shrugged aloud to me whenever I couldn't read anymore, because scanning my eyes over the words was causing that sort of stabbing sensation. But I finally said, I don't know what to do to calm this down. And this was about 2010 that I decided, well, it seems like the only break I can really get is if I take some rest in my bedroom away from everything. So what would happen if I just did that all the time? Because even though I say I was bedbound, I was out on a couch, still trying to be kind of social around my dog and whatnot. But even the heat of having my dog up against me was causing me more pain in that time. So I retreated to my bedroom. And my mom or dad would bring me food once or twice a day. And other than that, I was closed up in there for 9 straight months where I had a blackout shade up so that light couldn't come in and stimulate me. I had a white noise machine on so that I'd be able to just have something constant and I wouldn't be able to hear like movies or what my parents were doing outside. And that was really, really rough psychologically to just be shut away like that. And as I said, now I understand the nervous system. What happened to me while I was in there is that, well, what happens whenever you're in a quiet room and you hear a loud noise, you jump even more to something. So my nervous system got even more hypersensitive. And I finally snapped out of that by saying, this isn't working. And I developed all the facial pain from lying down all day. And that's whenever I came back out. And whenever I say that, things pretty much got truly awful, because at that point, the pain is pretty much a constant 8 or 9, where it's like a true 9, where it's interfering with my thought to such a degree, I can't speak a lot of the times because of how much it hurts. And I ended up sitting because this nerve pain would get triggered even worse if I laid down. And I had a 3-year period where I pretty much just sat in the same position, hunched forward so I wouldn't flex. And I tried to go to the bathroom as little as possible. I only walked to the bathroom each day. And I ended up awake on average during the last year of the worst stuff for over 30 hours at a time, just because the pain was so high that I couldn't feel tired anymore. I would eventually just conk out. So that's more the short version. Oh, one other thing I should include is that I was on narcotics for 10 straight years too. I was on a long acting and short acting and 3 different muscle relaxers. I was on 15 prescriptions simultaneously whenever I finally started to turn it around. But
and this is what the medical the doctors you were seeing, and you were trying specialists, you were trying a lot of different things, right?
Right. But, throughout my entire life, my parents, from the beginning, they started to try and get me help. So it was in and out of doctor's offices, even whenever I was in first grade. And by the time I was 10 years old, I remembered concluding that they can't really help me. So I just have to grit my teeth and push, which is what I did until I finally collapsed.
And that was one of the things that I gave you a hard time about in our annual emails.
Yeah, there was a lot about the duty premise in there. Yeah,
right.
Just mind over matter, that horrible phrase,
right, which
things like no
exacerbates
pain, no gain,
it. Right.
All those sorts of bad things. And so that's the short version of what I went through. And if anybody really wants the long version, I recommend going to my website for that, because I've recorded a couple of videos about it. And then this most recent interview that I did is an hour and 40 minutes long on natural evolution. And my website is balancehealthcoach.com, and it's BALANCE healthcoach.com. So that's where the full story is.
Okay, great. But people get a picture of, I mean, talk about being incapacitated. And I mean, one of the tragedies for me talking, you know, I mean, I had seen you, you know, at a little better time when you were posting regularly on HBL.
Right.
I mean, I'd been impressed by your mind and your grasp of objectivism and your goals for what you wanted to do. And of course, you had no capacity to pursue those goals during this really dark period. So it was really, I'm trying to figure out exactly the right word. I mean, the word tragic came up, but tragic is not quite the right. It was excruciating to hear about it, and it must have been more excruciating. In fact, I know from the emails that we had that your desire and your ambition to do something was actually part of the issue, right? In the sense that my experience, what I observed, and you tell me if this may be. You push back, but
sure.
I think you did a more extreme thing of what I did with my health problems. For those of you who don't know, I had overwork triggered Epstein-Barr for me, and I could not work for 9 months in 2016, 2017. And one of the things that I discovered there was that part of the problem was I was so upset about not being able to work. That actually got in the way, and I needed to really let go of that and work on not relapsing physically. And that was, you know, that was what I saw, is that you would get a little energy and then you would, you know, unleash your brain to try to go do something creative, and then you would crash.
Right. There was this hunger to achieve. And yes. I think that's truly one of the hardest things to figure out, is how exactly do you maintain your self-esteem and how do you have a sense of progress in your life whenever, you know, I mentioned this to you at OCON, that it's like you're in a lifeboat sort of situation where it's like I have a central purpose, but it's not really accessible to me right now.
Right. You need to be functional and able to be in order to do that. Right. And so you need to find things in a daily basis. So I know one of the things that we talked about and that you still offer is the five bright spots. Is that right?
Yeah, that I got from you.
Yeah,
and
right.
Before we jump into that, I should probably also just give the context of where I'm at now.
Yes. That's actually a really good idea. Good point, Christopher.
Yeah. So it's been nearly 5 years now since I started turning things around, and the recovery has accelerated as time went on. It was very much creeping during the first year. And I swear it's a coincidence. It has nothing to do with the play, but the night of January 16th, 2017 is whenever reality came calling for me and said that, all right, you're not going to make it much longer, because I was trying an experimental immunosuppressant drug. And I started losing my vision that night and started seeing these black spots all over the place, and ended up shaking for about 12 hours straight, where I thought, okay, maybe this is, because I've been very grounded and it's almost been metaphysical to me to be chronically ill, because it started so early and I learned how to cope to such a degree that I've been really level-headed. And that was really the only moment where I thought, okay, to that point, now I'm actually in trouble, even though it was really, really bad. But So that's whenever I realized I've got to look at things differently here. There's something flawed about everything that I'm doing, but now I'm 100% healthy, which is so shocking to me. I'm in the best shape of my life. All the autoimmune diseases that I have been in remission for 13 months now. I'm nearly pain-free despite having extensive nerve pain throughout my entire body. I've lost around 100 pounds. Well, actually, that's old data. I've put about 17 pounds of muscle on since I lost all that.
Good.
And I had lost 3 inches of my height from hunching forward so much. I got all that back. And now I'm just down to minuscule doses of 2 medications that I think I'll be able to stop here pretty soon. And it's pretty strange even now, even though I've had my business running since January, that I'm certified as a functional health coach. I'm writing a book with the one doctor who truly helped me, Dr. Jim Lemons, who was shockingly a behavioral psychologist with a specialization in neuroscience. And now I've got a regular spot on the Natural Evolution podcast. And pretty soon, the host, co-founder of the site Anora.com wants me to record a course to help other people deal with chronic pain because of my method and such. So now I'm on a mission to use my experience and knowledge to help others manage and overcome their chronic health problems.
Yeah, it's very, very inspiring. And it's terrific. You said one of the top things that Objectivism did is it gave you a method to figure out your health problems. Would you mind sharing that with us? Because I think that would be very interesting to everyone.
Right, because it is the most important part of this is the method of things. And really, I got a bit of a wake-up call. I almost simultaneously started studying health as soon as I became an Objectivist in 06, because I thought, I need to independently verify some of these things that I've been taking, essentially because I had so much respect for authority that I was listening to things like, oh, it's your genes. Your mother has interstitial cystitis. So of course you do. And there's nothing we can really do about that. So I started just a relentless search for looking into health information. And really, the 4 things that I think from Objectivism that I would most point toward as being helpful are the axioms for basically giving me the place to start. And on top of that, I kind of touched on this already, the independence of thought, to think that I kind of had a tendency to some second-handedness whenever I was younger and hadn't purged all those and took so many of these things just have from the knowledge perspective without verifying them. So that was really important. And holy moly, integration. The longer that I've been in Objectivism and now that I'm working with other people and helping them manage and sometimes reverse their health conditions, is seeing the entire picture and how everything is interconnected with the mind-body integration, because I had suspected that was a thing. I remember complaining in psychology class in college that I didn't really like the monist or dualist perspectives all that much. And so putting that together mattered too, and then context, and all of those deserve a bit of going into more, because really, you could talk all day just about those.
Right. What would you like to elaborate on that? Is that do you have some specific things you want to share there? Because I think that would be, the epistemology and the ethics are for living life. And I think this is a real concretization of that. So.
And I love that you said that. One of the things I joke with some of my friends about now is it's like this philosophy thing actually helps you live on earth.
Yes.
It's solved my health problems. So it's like looking at it from the base of things is having so much more of a long range view of man as such. And looking at, okay, there's millions of years of history here and evolution. How did we come to be this way? What worked for us in the longest term? And whenever I started thinking about that, I realized I am mismatched incredibly with what I'm doing currently whenever I'm really, really ill compared to how things used to be, how the body, the identity of the body, how it works. So how in the world is my body going to detox and flow lymph and what throughout the body and whatnot if I'm just sitting around all day, every day, trying to minimize my water intake so that I don't go to the bathroom? I'm never getting daily sunlight. So I've just lost touch at all this. And whenever I thought about it, I thought, you know, the body is excellent at survival. So if you just give it what it needs, it probably can run pretty darn well. So that's more of where the base of where I started working from. And then realizing that there's fundamental things that apply to all of us. And then how it works is the context of your biochemical individuality, how you approach these things. And in my research, it took about 7 years before it became really clear. And I was lucky enough to come into contact with some people who had an idea of the discipline of functional medicine, which I should briefly define, because functional medicine is essentially the same as like the conventional medicine system, except it looks for root causes of what's going on. It says, what is causing all these things? And then let's address them all simultaneously. And the most famous functional medicine doctor, Dr. Mark Hyman, says, all right, if you're standing on two nails and you take one out, you're not 50% better. You need to take them both out in order to get better. So looking at things from that sort of perspective and addressing everything, which encompasses the mind, and these six sort of things always came up once I finally started paying attention to it. And I put them together as diet and supplementation, and that can be for your genes as well, because everybody's got a specific makeup. I have a weakness in what's called the methylation pathway, which can make B12 problems be an issue. But the other categories are stress, and that I think is almost bigger than diet really at this point, that it's so powerful, and it's physical, chemical, and emotional stressors, because they're all insults to the body. And then exercise, and then sleep and sunshine are so closely related due to the rhythms that go along with that. And then the infection standpoint, and that can be things that are really overt or the things that are just under the surface that are very hard to detect. And unfortunately, conventional medicine uses ranges on averages for the population, and most of the population isn't all that healthy anymore. So functional medicine uses a different set of ranges that catches all sorts of things. And repeatedly, I see people come to me where their thyroid values are off and their doctor is telling them it's just fine. So there can be a lot of things that are kind of stealthy, where they're off, and even stealthy infections that are hard to deal with, like Epstein-Barr or Lyme disease.
Right. Yeah. And then, I was lucky to have a doctor one doctor diagnosed it, and another doctor said, no, that couldn't be the explanation, but it was absolutely the explanation.
Right. It was definitely the root cause of what's going on there.
Right. Yep.
And then the other thing that I associate with that too is environmental toxicity. And my bias as an objectivist didn't want that to matter at first. But whenever I realized, oh, what that actually means is something like my genes make it more difficult for me to deal with if I get any metal in my body. And I was rubbing aluminum-based deodorant on me for years, and it very easily gets stored in muscles, cause all sorts of aching, wouldn't be able to detox appropriately. So it was that side of things, but that was just me. That was my biochemical individuality. For other people, that's usually not really a problem. So there's a lot of variations there.
That's very interesting. So two small points of clarification. One person is asking, is integrative medicine the same as functional medicine, or are they different?
It's very, very similar, to the point where it may as well be considered the same thing, because it's looking at a very broad range of things. But I'm not certain. I haven't looked deep enough into it. I'm not sure if they use the same lab values or not. So that could be different.
Okay, great. But they have a similar kind of goal is what I think I'm hearing.
Yeah. Okay.
And I'll just make one comment. Maybe we'll talk about this at the end. I think stress is essentially psychological, and it's actually knowing how to manage your mind is the solution to stress. But we can talk about that a little bit later. But because that's one of your six things. The others are all much more physical, right?
Right.
Yep.
And the last thing that I hadn't mentioned is simply medications are wonderful and life-saving, but at the same time, you need to only be using as many of those, as few of those as possible, because the side effects of them. And now there's a really great website out there called mitavin.com. It's mitavin.com. And if you type any prescription in there, it tells you here are the micronutrients that get depleted by some of these medications. So I put in 15 medications and say, holy moly, no wonder I can't get better. I'm basically sapping all sorts of things out of my system. So medication reduction was one of the really key things in my recovery. But that's the sort of physical side of things and looking for the root causes and such.
Right. So what I'm hearing here, and let's just tie it back to metaphysics, epistemology. The metaphysics is you really got in there to understand the whole picture. And that's also the whole context. What are the facts? And one of the things that strikes me about this is you've kind of got encyclopedic knowledge now of these kinds of issues. I mean, it's a lot to take in.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I can, that's one of the reasons why I tell people that I can see why people don't get through these sorts of things, because it was a full-time job whenever I could spend the time on it to try and look into this as much as possible. And because so much was wrong with me, I needed to study a lot of different things and got knowledge on things I didn't really need to, but now it's proven very, very helpful for working with other people and for the book I'm writing. But yeah, and I think that that objectivism gave me this superpower of health integration, where I know that's the subject where I'm most interconnected on things.
Right. And I'll just mention one other thing. I think that, you know, if you look at the psycho-epistemological problems of our culture, compartmentalization is a rampant problem. It's a problem in medicine. It's a problem. I actually was talking with a friend of mine from MIT who, you know, became a professor in mechanical engineering, and I was, you know, saying, well, this is a problem. I was saying it was a problem in a different area, and he said, well, it's the same problem in engineering. Because he solved a problem that had an application to, you know, some other area, and they didn't want to hear anything about it. He used, you know, in the sciences, they literally use different unit systems in physics versus electrical engineering for Maxwell's equations. So you haven't automatized the same constants if you're in the different fields. And so there's a problem that you get these specialists in. If you step back, you can actually see that there are specialists reinventing the wheel in different places, but not talking to each other.
Yes.
And so that's what, you know, so your job was integration.
Right. And thanks for bringing that up, because that is one of the things that I wanted to mention, is that for most of my life, medicine has that going on too, where they just looked at me as a bladder disconnected from all the rest, not looking at, hello, once I start looking at the full picture, that my years with stress are whenever the symptoms go up the most, that perhaps there's a mind-body connection here that we need to look into too.
Right.
So, and there's plenty to say about the conventional medicine system that, I mean, it's brilliant for acute care, but it is subdivided into these specialties that one part's not really talking to the other. And part of that's the government intervention and diagnostic codes that causes this compartmentalization. But that's a whole other.
Let's focus on the positives here. You also, another major thing you want to talk about is how the value orientation was so important for coming out of this.
Right. And this is so much of where the mind comes into play. And I feel like this is where my book is going to be the most useful, because there's plenty of experts out there now, thankfully, that I read some of them to learn what I know about functional medicine and such. But of course, they don't have the same philosophic framework on mindset. So I can see now, especially here in the last year, it's been become very clear to me how important a value orientation is throughout every part of your life. That's truly what I set out starting to do, was setting up, as you taught me a long time ago, let's start getting some benevolent cycles going. And I find, even in my work with others now, that first one is the hardest, because everything seems like it's going wrong whenever there's chronic health problems. It really truly interferes with everything that you're doing. So I think of the value orientation. I think of it whenever it comes to diet. I think of it whenever it comes to ideas. That literally, I think that you can't properly heal without a proper outlook on the world and then taking the actions in your life. Because if you're having objective pleasure, for instance, you're getting beneficial biochemicals, you're getting endorphin release, you're getting oxytocin, you're getting serotonin. There's all sorts of things that are going along with that. And if you're sitting around thinking about how doomed you are and that this is never going to go away, you're basically inflaming yourself 24/7 whenever you're thinking about these limitations, which leads to a lot of misunderstanding in the ideas realm with the positive thinking crowd.
Right. Let's hold on 1 second. Let's make sure everybody understands what we mean when you said a benevolent cycle or a virtuous cycle. So this is something, let me just explain my take on it. And if you have a different take, you'll elaborate. Sure. So this is the idea. Like I talk about this in all kinds of, when you set a goal, you need to set up a virtuous cycle of action toward the goal, particularly a long-term goal, meaning that you need to be able to take a small action, that you have enough motivation, enough energy to take a small action that gets some kind of an observable result that gives you some kind of satisfaction, which then refills your motivation bank so that you're willing to put in the next effort. And one, you know, sometimes this gets simplified as take smaller steps, but it's not any old step. It has to be a step that actually gets a result that you see, oh yeah, this is making me better. That you actually see for yourself that this is an improvement. Now, sometimes you see the improvement, it's symbolic, or you need to actually do thinking to see the improvement, that it's not always a physical improvement in that sense. But you need to actually see that you're making progress. And if you don't see that you're making progress, you wind up burning out. You wind up only taking forward action by willpower, as opposed to when you take action, you're actually increasing your capacity to take the next action. I think this is a really important principle of goal-directed action, which is not well understood. There are a lot of common sense tactics that in fact help you get into a virtuous cycle, but the idea that this is what you're trying to do, I don't think is well understood. And I've been harping that song for a while.
I agree. And I feel like you are basically the Bible on the subject to this point, because your work has been so essential to helping me through things that I am eternally grateful for what you do. And in the broader sense, I can say for a fact, without objectivism, there's no way that I get out of this puzzle. And then even deeper on these specific topics, I can credit specific people for these things, like your work and then Tara Smith's book, Viable Values. And I'm part of the Austin Objectivism Group, and we've been going through the Ayn Rand Companion this year. And just for fun, before I got on the call, I did a control F on value in my Kindle copy, and there are 500 hits in there.
Right.
And it's just feel like I'm getting hit over the head on this. And I think I commented to you, I feel like you're writing to me all the time, like, here's advice on the values and such in order to get more oriented on this, because I can bring into that some of the science side of that as well. Like I mentioned, the biochemistry and then neuroscience too. There's the neuroplastic nature of the brain and such, and how whenever you're on the proper orientation, that builds patterns, builds new neural networks in your brain, and you start getting the benevolent cycle built, and suddenly there's this little spark of hope in your brain, and you get detached. And it's fascinating to me that I'll just touch on this briefly, because pain neuroscience is truly one of the most important subjects for anybody, that you can think, move, and breathe to alter the brain's responses to pain, because these other neural networks, whenever the pain gets established and whatnot, the brain starts networking every area of the brain, whether that's motor, whether that's sensory, anything involved. It could be a memory even, it could be the temperature, it can be all sorts of things get associated with the initial pain experience. Pain. Mm-hmm. And then it starts getting attached to other things as it spreads. So you need to actually step outside of it and make some new experiences and set up some new neurons. So there's a whole lot of good things just attached around that subject.
That's huge. And you know, it's interesting, the pleasure mechanism and the pain mechanism are sort of different. And what you're describing, it's interesting. I hadn't thought about this, but saying this is crystallizing. I think the pain mechanism is very much physical. That pain is physical, whereas pleasure, like when a lot of things you think, oh, well, that was painful. It was psychologically you were suffering. And it's really all about values and loss of values and grief and fear, which is not the same as pain. You know, pain is like, you know, someone, I had minor surgery on Friday, you know, there's like, there's pain. There's like a hole in the side of my leg. What is this? You know, it's different. So that's very interesting. One point of clarification, someone was asking about holistic versus integrative. I want to make a point here. Functional medicine is very science-based.
Right.
And I think what is normally the term holistic is, you know, there are some people who are anti science-based medicine, and that is not what we're talking about here.
Right.
Now, there are people who are looking for some alternative medicine things are in fact very reality-based. And I think some of that has actually come into some of your work. Is that right?
For sure, because there's the kooks and the quacks that go into that are the mystics for sure, which kept me at arm's distance. But and I'm pretty sure my book's going to get shelved as alternative medicine, so be it. I don't really see that because I see it as reality-based, and because I won't take on anything if there's not some sort of scientific proof on these sorts of things. But yeah, it's one of the things actually in the culture that gives me some hope is that I've met some amazing personalities in this space that are reality-oriented to a degree that I wouldn't expect in other areas where... because my recovery is not unique. There are so many people now that have gotten their lives back, and I got certified through Chris Kresser, who has written two books, The Paleo Cure, and then the other one is Unconventional Medicine. And I love what he says in these things. He has an amazingly first-handed approach to these. And Dr. Sarah Ballantyne's another one, Dr. Mark Hyman, they have written so many evidence-based articles for how all these things works because they're taking diet, they're taking supplements, and they're addressing the root causes of what's going on there on top of some of the mental things that definitely need more elaboration.
Right. Yeah. Great. Well, I'm wondering, I have three more things on my list that I'm supposed to ask you about. And I'm wondering, should we go through those and then take questions? Is that probably the thing to do here? Or did you have, am I missing something that you specifically wanted to say on number one or two?
Well, I think we covered number one very well, I think. Number two is one of those things that I think could go on for so long, just about the mind and how that works.
Yeah.
And how you can... rewire your nervous system in ways through how you think about things and how, like, the positive thinking crown. One of the things objectivism really helped me out with is seeing that there are these people that think that, oh, okay, you need endorphins and whatnot, so just put a smile on your face no matter what, which that's lying to yourself. Yeah. And you get these crazy eyed looks out of these types that are doing this all the time.
And it's emotionalism, right? Yes. It's saying that what it is I want to feel a certain way. Well, no, what you want, I mean, this is life is their objective needs for life. You need to take things that in fact help you live your life, that in fact give you actual success. And as a result of that, you get pleasure, not try to, you know, short circuit in some way that screws things up very badly.
Certainly. And I can say from reading so much of Ayn Rand, even to think about that, like, there's these awful phrases out there, like fake it till you make it and such, about, because like Dr. Lemons even said that one to me, and I pushed back immediately and said, well, it's more like train it till you maintain it, because you're not, thanks, you're not faking this. You're getting yourself oriented with a new idea of, because psychological threat assessment is one of the key tools for, and I'll give an example of this real quick, for helping pain. Like, I was only showering once every 2 weeks whenever I was at my worst. The hot water would make my nerves just burn for 3 days after I would take a shower. So it's amazing. There's a lot of things that my mind was filling in the blanks without me really explicitly saying it. By avoiding it, I was making it out to be like this life-threatening thing. So I'm pouring on the stress chemicals like crazy whenever I'm thinking these sorts of thoughts and simply avoiding it. And to my credit, I even figured this out before Dr. Lemons educated me in neuroscience. I thought, you know, that's what's going on here. So this isn't going to kill me. And it's amazing how just thinking that thought, and then whenever I'm going through it, thinking I'm going to be able to survive this, and this is good because I need to get the touch going again on my body. I need to get some lymph flow for moving things around. I need to detox better. I am not clean. All these things are good for me. So I start reprogramming my thinking, and it's not immediate. I know, due to objectivism, your emotions don't immediately reprogram whenever you're changing on these sorts of things, but it can be faster than you think.
Right. And if you take the positive action, and this is a great example of the, you know, the just do it is also wrong, because yes, the way most people tell you to just do it is to just forget about the things that you know, forget about the objections, just block that out, tunnel vision, you know this is what you're supposed to do, just do it.
Right.
But that's motivation by fear. That's saying, well, you know, I can't think about it in this. Whereas the alternative, which is demonstrated by what you just described, is you say, wow, okay, so this is going to be painful. And yet I know what this is going to do, and this is actually going to make me feel cleaner. This is, I can handle it.
Right.
It's I can handle it. It's going to be uncomfortable. It's going to lead me to be feeling better in the longer term.
Right.
I'm going to actually be clean. I'm going to smell better. I mean, whatever it is that you were saying to yourself, but you know, you get really focused on what the positives are and that you can handle it.
Yes.
And then it's an act of volition to say, okay, I can handle this, and I can see why I'm doing this. I'm going into the shower. And
right,
that's how every virtuous cycle gets started at the beginning, because like if you set a new long range goal, you don't automatically have motivation to do it. And there are always parts of working toward a long range goal that you don't necessarily feel like, or you're afraid of, or whatever. And until you get expertise in that area, it's not going to be, oh, I want to do that. And so this is not just recovering from a problem. This is inherent in goal-directed behavior, that you need to be able to say, oh yeah, this is uncomfortable or scary or whatever it is, and I really see the benefits of it, and I can handle it, and I'm going to take that step. And so, but this is just such a dramatic life or death case of it. Kristen.
Right. And it's, Dr. Lemon says to me, the proof is in the pudding, that clearly it worked what I did on all these things. And this is where objectivism, again, helps so much, that having the mind-body integration here, that I can see that I can change my thinking and it can actually have a physiological effect.
Yes.
On my body. A lot of it's really tempting to think of like the physiology only affecting your mind. I find with a lot of the people that I work with, I think, oh, I hurt, and then my thoughts get going. Well, it's a two-way street on all those.
Yep.
Things. And the other thing, the last thing point I want to make about this example is how objectivism helped through certainty. Certainty,
yes,
achieving certainty will speed,
yes,
up the process.
Yes.
Much more. And I see that's my secret sauce, where people say, how do you change so quickly? Well, I examine all the evidence. I am convinced by it, and I can be sure. I don't have to say, well, that may be true for you, but it's not true for me. I know for a certain, this is how the body works.
Right. That's actually a really interesting point. I think that makes that's a great observation, Christopher. And part of the issue is finding certainty even when there is uncertainty. So like being able to say, be certain that you should do this experiment.
Yes.
Even though you don't know how it's going to come out, but you're right, certain that this is going to get you information that is going to make a difference.
And that's that first win is important too,
yeah,
because
yeah,
getting that first success, it can help solidify the certainty for somebody who's kind of on the fence with a thing to dare,
yeah,
to hope a little bit more.
Yes. Right. Right. Yeah. And that of course is where, that's where it's incredibly person specific, right? This,
yeah,
this is, people have been talking about on HBL about objectivism is hard. And I think that's the wrong way to look at it. I think objectivism is clear and you can understand it quickly, but often the application is complicated and it's not obvious.
Yes.
And in this kind of case, it can be, the principles are straightforward and clear, but then you need a lot of knowledge about the concretes, and you need to be good at seeing the principles in the concretes, which is, I think that's the skill that I think is lacking, which I think you have. You think in principle, and that's what you can do for your clients, I'm sure.
I think so too, because I see that in like disarming flare-ups for people and such, because I can see the whole playing field of what's going on. Yes. If a lot of people say, well, I ate this and now I feel bad, then I ask them, well, what else were you doing physically? Right. Oh, suddenly it comes out that I was out in a field of pollen yesterday, right. Or I had a really distressing feeling. But I agree with you. I feel like objectivism is really straightforward. As soon as I read it, I thought, oh my gosh, this is so clear. This is the clarity I've always wanted, but the applications are difficult. And then I now see the specialized sciences, where the difference is and how I need to have a knowledge of health in order to fully understand how to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. Fantastic. So your number three point, for those who came on early, I put these in the chat. I guess I'll put them again now so that everybody who came on later can see them.
These are rapid fire too. I have less to say on these. So,
what do you mean by the non-alternative of life versus death? That's very intriguing.
Okay, so just realizing that, because I was an agnostic, essentially, I was thankful that I was brought up without religion throughout my life. But I'm actually the first objectivist in my family. Everybody else came over after.
And he got them all in. I've met them all. Yes.
He's on board.
He has a great family.
Yeah, I am very, very fortunate. And thanks to the support from my family as well. That's key to the recovery. But the non-alternative here is that whenever I realize, okay, atheism, yes, there is no God. And it's part of the value perspective too, that the zero is not a thing. Mm-hmm. So there's no way I'm going to give up on my life by thinking about suicide whenever I have so many things to explore. That a lot of people say, how did you not give up? It's like, well, I saw no alternative.
If you die, then there's nothing.
There's nothing. Right. There's nothing that I'm going to, what I've had to this point, I knew that, well, I didn't even really have like a normal childhood experience. I was already shut down when I was 10 with like exercise-induced asthma to not be athletic anymore. There were so many things that I'd not had that I absolutely wanted to hang around for life to see. And I continually held on even before objectivism, thinking that, well, if I just survive long enough, that somebody will figure this out if I don't. So I just need to stick around.
Right. So this is, so you saw that your life was precious.
Yeah.
And that is a root. That is wonderful.
And that's been something that feels like it's been there. I can't even separate it from memory at this point, where it's always there. I remember being highly resentful whenever I saw some movie, I can't even remember what it was, when I was like 18, it was about like figuring out to appreciate your life because you have cancer. And I thought, well, I'd appreciate my life without having to have my nose stuffed and horrible.
I don't like this at all. Right. Yes. Yeah. I'm on a campaign for that too. You should be able to grow and, take it to the next level without having to be in some horrible, stressful, external circumstance. You should be able to just do that. That's actually part of my work too. Well, that's very exciting, Christopher. What about number four? This one, I think I know more what you say. Heroism is possible in daily life. Recontextualize self-esteem.
Okay, so I think this is one of the best things about objectivism for everyone, and is essential in a chronic health problem, is thinking about that heroism is possible just by being a virtuous person. And thinking about, and I struggled, and if you recall, we had a phone call actually whenever we were arranging the thinking tactics workshop, and I started to tell you something was wrong, and then I pulled back because I didn't tell you until we met in person about my health problems, because I had this shame around the productivity, because I thought, I am the least productive objectivist out there. I'm not doing anything. I'm just in pain all the time. And I'm just sort of eking by. So having to recontextualize what self-esteem meant within this like lifeboat sort of thing, that I realized that I'm still a good person from I'm trying to survive here and I'm meaning well, I'm trying to do everything that I can here. So I can still feel good about myself, even if I'm not, because I want to be a fiction writer. Even if I'm not writing my fiction novels, I am maintaining and I'm being a good person toward others. I'm upholding these values. So
you're staying in focus, right? Yes. The essence of morality is that you engage your mind to deal with reality. And you were doing that within the best knowledge that you could.
Right. And I was trying my darndest because I was on narcotics for 10 years. It made it pretty darn hard to do that. That I remember us even meeting and it's like, I was on them then. Those things were on my mind at that time. It was very hard. And I had to unpack some guilt at times because during my worst few years, I got onto max dosage of both the long acting and short acting narcotics. And I kind of lost track of trying to get better there for a while. And whenever that occurred to me on January 16th, 2017, I had a flood of guilt of realizing, oh my goodness, maybe I'm not this good person who's been trying so hard. But thankfully I had some good voices in my ear on top of thinking that these medications were doing a lot of things to me affecting that.
But I think this is also a very, very important issue. I've been writing about this and teaching this in the Thinking Lab, particularly this year, that as part of self-esteem, you need to be able to, something that you did in the past that you feel guilty about, and in your case, I think these were innocent errors. I think you were doing what you thought was the rational thing to do, but it actually turned out to be a mistake.
Yes.
And it's true, even if it was irrational, you need to be able to go back and look at past mistakes, and first of all, you need to be able to heal them. And the way I think you do that is first by understanding, how did this get made? And what have I learned from it? And what values was I after that I was pursuing in a mistaken way here? And I think that's very important to do that, so that you understand it was a real person making a mistake rather than, you know, oh my God, there's something wrong. There's this this demon inside me making me think. That's part of it. And the other thing is really understanding how learning from that helps you go forward. And when you do that, when you don't do those two things, when you look at that thing in the past that you felt so shameful about, instead you look at it, my God, that was an incredible learning experience. And it really changes your experience of yourself and your view of yourself, because you have learned from that mistake. And that is, I think, one of the critical parts of really maintaining self-esteem.
Yes, and I think that is one of the absolute essential tools to have in one's toolkit for psychology, because it's one of these things, too, that I've realized that my favorite compliment that I've got is based on this subject is, this nurse was talking to me and she said, oh my gosh, it's like nothing ever happened to you. And a lot of people see that physically, but she meant that mentally too, where I'm not scarred and bitter about all these years that I lost and whatnot, because I didn't see much point in dwelling on that about what I lost, because I thought, well, I've already paid for that.
Right. Right.
I have all this time left to do other things to achieve my value. So my focus is 100% on that. I'm not going to sit around and say, well, darn, I don't have all these things.
Right. And you also can talk about it. It's not something that you've put in, because I think sometimes people say, well, I don't want to think about it, and they put it in a box.
Yeah.
And that causes its own psychological problems. That causes another kind of compartmentalization. Whereas here, you can look at it, you understand it, and honestly, I think that I have much less physical problems than you, but having seen that and dealt with it in that way, you can empathize with someone who is in a similar situation. And Sarah is just putting in the chat, the self-esteem point is so important in chronic disease, because one of the worst aspects of it can be the guilt and shame of not being able to do the things you think you should. I mean, I've been on a campaign against the duty premise since Epstein-Barr, because it took my not being able to work for 9 months to really understand that the duty premise was killing me.
Yeah.
And it really is. It is, it's a huge issue. So kudos to you. And I mean, Christopher is really just, I'm so glad to introduce you guys to him, because you hear how inspiring his story is. It's really, it's an amazing story, and Christopher's an amazing guy.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Now, we're just about at the end of our hour, and why don't we finish the interview, and then I think there's some people who want to ask questions. Sure. Are you going to be able to stay on for a bit for the after party?
For sure, yeah.
Okay. Okay, great. So your last thing that you said objectivism helped you with was aesthetics for fuel. I can guess that one.
Yeah.
You tell me more about it.
Because there are so few sources of light and value that you can self-generate whenever you're down and out like that. But this goes into what you were talking about very early on about the 5 bright spots that I got from you. So, mm-hmm. And the 3 good things book that I've been doing now every single day, ever since you mentioned it to me in 2010, I've kept that practice going.
Let's just explain those 2 things. So 3 good things. You can actually, both of these are written up on my website, but 3 good things. I got this from Martin Seligman. It's he calls it a gratitude practice. I don't call it a gratitude practice, because that I think is based on a religious view. The idea is that every day you, without fail, you write down 3 good things that happened. If you do it at the end of the day today, or if you do it in the morning yesterday. And I've added to that, also write down why they make the list. And this is something that if you are depressed, this is something that can help you actually focus on the good things in your life. Genuinely positive things. And it's also a great, if you add in explanation for why is this making the list, you can get really a lot of self-understanding about your values. And it's a practice. What Seligman said is if you don't know him, he's a very famous psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania. And at a certain point, someone said to him, "Dad, you're always unhappy." And he realized, why isn't psychology helping people to be happy? And he is one of the leaders of the positive psychology movement that has happened in the last like 10 or 15 years. And he did a number of studies. And one of the reasons he mentioned this is, of all the things that they tried with undergraduates, who all the experiments are with, this tactic of doing 3 good things a day had the longest lasting results. And the reason it did is that people kept doing it indefinitely, because it was so nice to do it. It becomes a practice. It's such an easy practice. It has great benefits. The other one, the 5 bright spots, this is something that my therapist told me when I had Epstein-Barr, which I passed on to you, because it's so demoralizing. If you're an ambitious person, and as my infectious disease specialist said, the people who get hit by these things tend to be ambitious people. And I think it's because we overwork ourselves into these, we get these more dramatic physical problems because we are willing to push through all the pain.
Yeah, Dr. Lemon says the same thing. He said everybody sees, he labels them type A, which we don't need to go into that.
You know, you have real goals and you want to do it and you're willing, you know, and it was so demoralizing to not be, I literally couldn't work. The only thing I could keep up with on those 9 months was I could do HBL administration, which was so mindless. That was the only thing I could do. I couldn't do any work on my work. And she said, look, you need something to be able to see that you're accomplishing something each day. So you need to come up with 5 things that you can do every day and then do them without fail. And this is basically what you said is your goal. And so I think mine were, I believe one was call my mother. One was, there was this Qigong exercise, which was like, it was just, you stand and you move your hands a little bit for 5 minutes. And it's sort of like a breathing exercise.
Right.
And that was the only exercise I could do. And then there was, I did an Alexander technique self lesson, which was something that's another whole story I can talk about. 3 good things was on my list of bright spots. I can't quite remember what the 5th one was, but you probably had your list of 5 bright spots.
For sure. And there's some overlap there too. Yeah. I had talking with my mom was always one of them. And the aesthetics point was there, because even though I had an English degree, I didn't get introduced to great art. It's like, who's this Victor Hugo person that Ayn Rand's talking about? I should go read him. So, and I was kind of fortunate. A lot of people tell me I was kind of like in my own gulch, that because I couldn't do anything else, I was away from the culture entirely, disconnected from everything. So I had like a 4-year period where I was alone with Ayn Rand and Leonard Peikoff and then Harry Binswanger and just reading everything that Ayn Rand recommended. So I went through Victor Hugo, through Dostoevsky, through Agatha Christie, through Mickey Spillane. And then I eventually, once my nervous system was a little better, I was watching movies. And then I started watching some Bollywood things, because there can be some great uppers in their musicals that are endorphin producing, and reminding myself that value is what matters here, and not the devastation of what I was going through, but that I could have these sorts of values in my life, even if I couldn't run out and dance.
I caught up on every movie I'd never seen during the 9 months I had seen Barbie. We had the four DVDs a month for Netflix, and I was just lying on the bed watching movies.
It's great for that. Oh, Frasier too. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And Frasier. You know, and this is real. You know, this is, I mean, people don't understand about art. Art is, aesthetics is one of the five branches of psychology. You need to be able to, philosophy. Thank you. Thank you, Christopher. You need art in your life. You need to see that vision of life as it can be and ought to be. And particularly when you're in these incredibly dark periods, you really, really need that.
Yeah, the point got driven home to me of how life-sustaining and necessary it is to be in those circumstances, where I literally needed that every day to keep going.
You needed, and it in effect to you, this is not escapism. This is spiritual fuel. Spiritual fuel. Yeah, and it's real. It's real. No. Well, I mean, yours is an amazing story, Christopher, and I'm really, really excited. You're now helping other people. Do you want to say a word or two about your coaching business before we close?
Sure, because I realized, like, I almost became a doctor after all this. I truly looked into going to Institute of Functional Medicine, becoming a doctor, but I thought, I don't want to go back for a couple of years to get this kind of certification at the minimum. Even though I can read all the lab values, and I had to learn it to fix myself. But, I wanted to be on the motivational side of helping people come up with plans and figure out what lifestyle things are contributing and what ideas are contributing. So I went into the coaching to get certified, but then everybody came to me and said, "Oh my gosh, Christopher, what'd you do to get better?" So I also do this consultation thing where I always, for free, 90 minutes, I let people come to me. I ask them questions from this foundation of, see what all's going on, see if I think I can be of help, if they need a neuroscience education. And then if they come back to me, and I should mention this on here, I have a secret good epistemology discount that's not on my website. But my initial consultation's usually $500 if we work together, but I do it for $250 if somebody's an objectivist. It's in my interest that we're all feeling great.
Right. Okay. Fair enough.
And I go off and I'll research them for up to 10 hours, and I'll put together a hierarchical guide of, like, here's your top three or your top five based on what you're going through, what's most likely to be your best bang for your buck. And if I think that you need a further practitioner, because I don't diagnose, I don't treat, I don't sell supplements, I don't run tests, I refer them to a particular practitioner that I've referred to, because I have 13 practitioners referring to me now. So I'm getting, and my network just keeps growing, but it is amazing to me to see that I'm 100% so far on everybody that's come to me has had some degree of improvement. And I can't really say where they're going to end up. It depends on their age, depends on how extensive the damage is and how much they do.
How much effort they put in.
Yeah, the effort that they put in. But it's truly, I feel like I never work a day in my life, because it is so joyful to me. I don't get drained from it. I'm like, what's the next call? Seeing these people get their lives back after this. Yeah. I never thought I would be helping people do this, but it's amazingly rewarding work.
It's fabulous. Just, I mean, congratulations to you on all levels. It's really inspiring to see what you have done.
And I should mention one last thing about the coaching too, because this is something you know so much about, is that truly everybody wants my consultation, but I see the real changes happen in the coaching, because it is so hard to keep the motivation up on these things long-term, to keep delving into your values and keep in touch with them. That's where I've seen the big changes. And I had one young man get his autoimmune disease into remission in 6 weeks, which blew me away.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, having an objective second person helping you stay focused on the values can be really, really helpful.
Right. You really can get really stuck on seeing what you didn't do rather than what you do, the shifts, the successes that you did have, and why you want to have more of.
Right. And of course, the knowledge of objectivism in that, of seeing what it is that you want to focus on rational values.
Yes.
It's priceless.
Yeah. Getting to the deep rational values. Yep. Like, I emailed you when I enrolled in my coaching course and you talked to me about how I needed to have an armor for what I was going to hear. To think about what they're going to say to me versus what I know and what I need to think about reducing these to values.
Right. Right. Fair enough. All right. Well, I think we're going to draw a line on the official program here, but thank you very much, Christopher. I see we already have some hands up, so we'll continue in the after party. But for everyone else, Harry will be back next week. And thank you for listening.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks.